Welcome to the Ron Lanton Report. I'm Ron Lanton, and today I am joined by Melanie Whittington, otherwise known as Mel. She is the Managing Director and Head of the Leering Center for Pharmacoeconomics. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me.
I think this is going to be exciting, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us today. So thank you for participating.
Of course.
So let's get right down to it. This is our season finale. This is our first season. Very exciting things that we've talked about over the past five episodes, which has kind of been a build up to this conversation. And what's interesting in talking with you offline, I think the appropriate title for today is Episode Six: What Are We Doing All of This For? Because, we have seen things from innovation, we have seen things from trade, we have seen all these external factors that have affected drug pricing and just drug development. That you have to kind of think of the obvious question, which is why? Why are all these things happening? What are we doing this for? And I can't think of anybody better to come and talk about this and help me answer this question than you today.
Oh, well, thank you, Ron, and congratulations on the first season. This is
Yeah.
huge. I've enjoyed listening to your podcast, and I really appreciate the opportunity to help you close it out and talk about that why, because we don't talk
Yes.
about that enough.
We don't. And it's one of those obvious things when you ask the question, it's a light bulb moment. You're like, well, we're so used to just talking about this issue by issue and who gets impacted and what law happens and yeah, why is this why? So I guess this leads me to my first question for you, which is why does continued innovation matter for patients, the healthcare system, and society as a whole?
So I don't love the word patients. I prefer, people or individuals because, Ron, this is all of us. We will all be a patient at some point in our life. One of our loved ones, all of our loved ones will all be a patient at some point in our life. So this is really all of us. Why does continued innovation matter to us as individuals? And the reason is pretty simple. We all want to live full, healthy lives. We want solutions to our problems. And, what's the first thing that happens when you or a loved one gets diagnosed with something or is dealing with something? You ask, like, well, what treatment is out there to make this go away? What treatment is out there to solve this problem? And so that is what innovation can do. And this became really clear to me. I kind of talk about like the tale of my two moms. So in the last couple of years, both my mother and my mother-in-law were both diagnosed with cancer. And my mother was diagnosed with a type of cancer that fortunately has a lot of treatment options available. There has been innovation in the last, 30 to 40 years where her prognosis was terrific. Now that she is through treatment, her life expectancy is near normal. The life that she lives today is nearly essentially the same as it was prior to her diagnosis. I'm not going to say while she was on treatment, it was a walk in the park. She's a champ. But right now that we're mostly through it, things look great. Innovation has made the management of her cancer, that word that is so scary. In her particular case, innovation has made it so her cancer is more like a chronic disease rather than a deadly cancer. And then there's my mother-in-law, who was diagnosed with a cancer with essentially no treatment options. I remember when I first, was researching it, it was described in the press as a clinical wasteland. And nearly at the time of her diagnosis, our lives pretty much completely changed. Very quickly after diagnosis, she required full-time care, and her life and our lives were forever changed. And now we're 2 years post her diagnosis, and very sadly, she's died. And that's what can happen when there isn't any innovation. So innovation gives us, yes, patients, people, individuals, it gives us solutions to our problems and can help us live those full, healthy lives we desire. Now, innovation does more than that for people. As you mentioned in your question, it also talks about the healthcare system and society. And that's something I always encourage people to talk about is these spillovers of innovation, not just for the person receiving it, but for the system and for society. So let's think about the healthcare system. For the healthcare system, innovation gives the healthcare system new tools in their toolkits to be able to help people live full and healthy lives. Now, my area of expertise is in biopharmaceutical innovation. And biopharmaceutical innovation is particularly unique in that it's governed by patents, right? And patents are really unusual in that after a patent expires, then competitors, the direct competitors, can enter into the market and make prices drop, hopefully near their, marginal cost of production. And so the more biopharmaceutical innovation that you can get that is able to prevent or reduce other types of healthcare services that don't approach that kind of marginal cost of production over time means that's how we get more health system efficiencies. So not only do we get more tools in our toolkits to be able, to help patients and people and individuals live healthier and help healthier lives, but we can work to system efficiencies by this, creating something that does go down in price over time to offset things that don't. And then the last thing is society. Innovation promotes health. And what happens with health? Healthy people are able to be productive and they're able to work and they're able to volunteer and they're able to get an education and they're able to contribute more to society. And so innovation really creates this progress, and progress is good for society.
It is. And first of all, before I even start to comment on what you said, I'm really sorry to hear that news.
Well,
And
thank you.
it's one of those things where sometimes we forget that there are real people involved, because especially for myself, you're thinking of all these policies and you're like, oh my God, this is going to affect the supply chain, or this is going to affect this manufacturer, this is going to affect this pharmacy. But then a lot of that patient, effectiveness is left out of the equation. So thank you for sharing that. That really does help put a human face on this, because that's what we're doing. This is what they're for. So I think that's a valuable lesson that we all have to remember. I think maybe I'll save that thought for the second question here that I have for you, which is, how do we make healthcare and medicines more affordable without unintentionally changing what gets funded, developed, or brought to patients?
Yeah, it's a great question. And affordability is a challenging term because affordable and valuable and efficient and optimal, they're not the same things, right? And so when I often think about affordability, if I'm thinking about it as affordability as like a person or a patient or an individual, the affordability component is largely why we have insurance, right? We buy insurance to spread out the costs across the population, to protect ourselves against any kind of high unexpected financial shock. And so that's why we have insurance. And so having adequate insurance with low patient out-of-pocket costs is kind of one mechanism for affordability. But that affordability term has always kind of challenged me. But the last part of your question, unintentionally changing what gets funded, developed, or brought to patients, I really like that. And if we think, okay, we want to incentivize innovation, we also want to promote like a valuable, efficient healthcare system. Without changing what gets funded, developed, and brought to patients, how do we do that? And so, what I would suggest is thinking about what are things that can happen after that patent period, after that exclusivity period, because that exclusivity period and expected sales, expected revenue, expected utilization, et cetera, all over that exclusivity period is what is driving R&D, what is driving more innovation. It's what's incentivizing investment. And one term that I like and kind of anchors a lot of the work that and my philosophy about this is was coined by Dr. Peter Kolchinski about the biotech social contract. And he talks about this market-based pricing over a patent-intended period of time, going back to those patents being so central to biopharmaceutical innovation, but then also followed by timely entry of generics to drop that price near that marginal cost of production. And so how do we ensure adequate incentives exist for those market-based principles to work for generic or biosimilar competition to enter quickly after that patent intended period of time so that those prices can drop near the cost of production? Because that post-exclusivity period, that isn't what is driving those investment conversations and incentivizing those investments. It is really that exclusivity period that's doing that. So how can we think about that post-exclusivity period and finding efficiencies and things to improve there? Again, and no, and maybe one other thing I want to say here is I think I'd be remiss in not alluding to it because it is so timely. A lot of the press in the last, week or so has been talking about how we just experienced the biggest annual decline in prescription drug prices since I think it was like 1963, right? Like we're in 2026. 1963, we just experienced the biggest annual decline in prescription drug prices. Prices usually don't go down over time for things, right? But they can for prescription drugs. And that number and that's analysis isn't super clear as to like what all goes into it and what is exactly driving this. And it's probably driven by a lot of different things, all that have happened in relatively similar time periods. But I think without a doubt, a portion of that is because we have had some major generic and biosimilar entrants for high utilization, high price branded drugs. And so this whole concept of we have this exclusivity period that's protected by a patent where prices for pharmaceuticals are meant to be high to incentivize what is going to get developed, invested, and brought to patients. But then after that, we have this period where the product is available and competition can enter and hopefully drop the cost down to the marginal cost of production. That's kind of how this can all work out.
What is really interesting about 1963, first of all, that's a long time
A
to
ton.
measure that and see that. And I know we've talked about biosimilars on in other conversations. I guess I'm kind of wondering too, because we've had other conversations about some incomplete policies, right? Like most favored nation and direct to consumer pricing and things like that. And those have they've been around. But I think during this administration, they've been brought to the forefront a little bit more, even though there hasn't really been like a lot of concreteness around these ideas. It's more like, when the Federal Reserve comes on and they say, oh, yeah, we want to, control pricing. So we want to either raise interest rates or we're thinking about lowering interest rates. And the market kind of takes care of itself. So I'm wondering, you mentioned generic and biosims, and those are things that we've measured with, definite statutes and policy changes and FDA rules and things like that. These other ideas, do you think those are more jawboning and, have they contributed, do you think, to that downward trend? Or has it just been the generics and biosimilars, in your opinion, because they've had a longer runway to develop?
I don't know. I'm sure, there's been so many things that have happened and so many, eyeballs on prescription drug pricing that I'm sure every, thing that you mentioned might be contributing something, at least something to it. These aren't done in randomized controlled trials where we can say, hey, this is responsible for this. But we do have this history, particularly in the small molecule generic market, where generics can enter after that patent period of time and dramatically drop prices overnight. And so I would think various activities, direct to consumer, MFN conversations, Inflation Reduction Act, I'm sure they all play some role in it. But I think the thing that we have the longest standing evidence for is the success of generic entry and its subsequent reduction on price. This just seems like a more straightforward line to be able to draw. If you look at Entresto in the last year, generics have entered for that, and the price I think is like 99% cheaper than it was during the exclusivity period, and that happened very, very quickly. And so I think we just have more maybe transparent and obvious linkage to the success of the generic drug industry.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's exactly the reason for what we're seeing. And I think that's a good thing that we're seeing the downward spiral of that is definitely needed. There was a question I was going to hold on to. I think it's probably the right time to bring it up. It's really a tie between questions one and two. And I don't know really if this is a statement or a question, but I'm going to say it and see what it comes out as. So, you mentioned innovation and you mentioned, how do we make things, affordable without really unintentionally changing these other subjects that we had talked about. I wish that we had a policy mindset, at least where the US would maybe look at and adopt some of the international way of thinking just on this point, where we look at healthcare as a business. And I can know a lot of people will say, well, no, we actually do that. Okay, well, If we look at something and we say, all right, this drug may cost you $80,000, like the Sovaldi issue in 2013, right? And this cures you 9 out of 10 times. And think about all the money that you're saving over your lifetime. Whereas our system right now is built on maintenance. And I think that's why we're having such a hard time with the payers saying, well, wait a minute, that's a lot of upfront costs, but we don't know what we're going to redeem over time. I don't know if we ever get out of that quagmire or not. What do you think about that? Because I think that really is going to play into how fast we have that balance between innovation and lowering cost.
Yeah, and I think the main word there is, or main phrase is over time. I think this is this trickiest part because a lot of things can happen over time. And innovation, if we really want to think about, like the value of innovation, innovation has a product lifetime of, how long, right? Like it's not only the 14 or so years that it's protected by a patent and has that exclusivity period, it can be in the market forever and it has a whole life cycle. And so thinking about the value of an innovation over its life cycle versus at launch is a very, very different conversation. But our budgets, our policies are often set up to be thinking more short term, but we can't be thinking about short term with innovation because innovation in the short term is very different than innovation in the long term. You mentioned Sovaldi. Sovaldi, initially launched, I think, at a price around 80,000, but now I think that class of medicines competition, not even, generics aren't even available yet. This is just therapeutic competition, branded competition with other competing agents has dropped prices down to, around $10,000 to $15,000, I think. This is all before generics have entered. And so if we think about not only the difference in time of maybe you have more of this upfront cost for those medicines for a long-term benefit, we also have upfront higher costs over that product's life cycle, for the years that it will be protected by a patent, but then those costs can of course still go down or up, but can go down in the case of this class of medications over the exclusivity period due to brand competition. And this is all before we get direct copies, generics entering the market and working to drop the prices even lower. And so this aspect of time is so challenging, particularly with pharmaceuticals that can have benefits over a long term with costs maybe more concentrated, and this whole life cycle component where the price of a pharmaceutical can vary dramatically from and is intended to vary dramatically across its life cycle.
Well, this is a perfect segue into my next question then. So, when we talk about the value of innovation, do the tools that we use actually capture everything that matters to patients and society? And if not, what do you think we're still missing?
So value innovation, this is my jam. Like, I love talking about the value of innovation. And I'm a pharmacoeconomist. That is just, a terrible word to describe. I think about the costs and consequences of innovation, not just the costs, but also those impacts that we talked about that are so important, right? And our field of pharmacoeconomics and health economics and outcomes research for, decades has done a lot of great work thinking about what should go into those models that we're building to think about the costs and consequences of pharmaceuticals. And, we talk about different perspectives, which is really just, okay, are we only thinking about health system costs and patient health benefits? Or should we be thinking about societal perspective and thinking about patient productivity, caregiver time, caregiver quality of life, and all of these kind of spillovers that can happen to society that we already talked about. So the field of pharmacoeconomics and health economics and outcomes research has done a lot of great work in this space and thinking about, like what matters, what can be quantified, what can be put in. And so those are all really commendable efforts. I think the biggest gap, though, that still remains is this time component that we just talked about. So I've mentioned these patents. I've mentioned the life cycle of a drug, right? Life cycle of a drug is characterized by a period of market exclusivity at the very beginning, where prices are typically higher. There can still be, of course, branded competition. And then after that, generics or biosimilars can enter and drop their prices, right? And so how we typically think about how pharmacoeconomics and kind of cost effectiveness analysis is typically applied is more thinking about for a patient who starts the treatment at launch, what then happens to them over that patient's lifetime? So it takes a time horizon of a patient who starts the treatment at launch, and it assumes everything pretty much stays the same. So for the case of, like, say, Sovaldi, say it was $80,000 at launch, it's going to assume over that whole time horizon of the model, decades, that that price would stay at 80,000. Okay, but what about price changes during that time horizon? We've already seen price changes and we don't even have generics yet. And that's just for a patient at launch. Now let's think about someone who starts the drug 10 years after it's been in the market. What about 20 years in the market, right? So there's this really big difference between thinking about the value of innovation from, kind of anchoring it on the product lifetime. So thinking about the time that this product is in the market, what will its costs and consequences be? To what is more traditionally done, and that is to thinking about for a patient who starts the treatment at launch, assuming that launch price stays constant, right? Like those are two very different frames, and the latter is what we typically do. And so I think where the field will make advancements and maybe where, certain things that might be missing or not considered is that the product can be in the market forever. But the innovator only has this, time limited and at the front of that time to be able to attempt to generate a return on their investment. And so how we're grappling with the time horizon of our models for the value of innovation is really, really hard because, again, there's this difference between what is typically done, a patient lifetime at launch versus a product lifetime and accounting for, life cycle considerations of the innovation. It's tricky.
It's very tricky. And I didn't want to get into this question with you, but I guess I'll do it now since I've stepped in it. because now, when I was talking about the changes that we're seeing the administration push through, the various changes, with all these different GARD and GLOBE models and things like that. And we're still waiting on some of these models to come out from CMS officially so people can plan. It makes it very, very tough. I mean, you're already talking about how the environment is tough and how do we do, R&D costs and how do we get that back and all of that. But like, that just seems like we're in this world now where people, it feels like they can't plan. But I tell them when they feel that way, just do what the rules say right now until we get some kind of clarity for what this is. Do you still feel the same way with that? Or how do you approach something like that now? Or do we just kind of go about as we are, or do we maybe try to think theoretically, maybe some of this might come to fruition and we have to be prepared? That part I struggle with.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm glad people have people like you to help them with that. I don't know. I tend to think more of kind of larger themes and the how what we're doing today sends signals and incentives for investment, and that all kind of dictates and determines what our future innovation is going to be. And one of my biggest lessons learned since engaging more with, development stage companies and biotech investors is thinking about, okay, the prices and the how we are rewarding pharmaceuticals today, those are all like little incentives for innovation of, okay, that is that prize. It's not just a price, but it's a prize of okay, I'm going to invest some dollars here in an attempt to maybe get a piece of that prize. And so I don't have a good answer for your question, but I just want to reiterate that the things that we do today are signals for investment and incentives for investment that will, shape what the future innovation looks like.
Yeah, I don't think there really is a real answer to that. It's almost like you're looking into the future every day and trying to determine, what things are. It's very, very difficult already to lead a pharma company or any of these others, with the rules that we already have. So, that's difficult, but it actually helps because I guess we can keep our crystal balls out and look at our other question I was going to ask you, which is, if we succeed in solving some of the problems that healthcare faces today, what becomes the next constraint? And What is the problem that we're not paying enough attention to right now?
A really good question. I think, given what I've already talked about, I would have to say, okay, the small molecule generic market has been massively successful in getting very steep price declines and very quick price declines after that patent period of time. What about a biosimilar market? What about cell and gene therapy, right? So as we're getting these other types of treatments, can those markets, can the biosimilar market, how can we get steeper and larger price declines while still incentivizing that biosimilar space after that patent intended period of time? And I think there has been some research that's looking at, are we seeing more biologics, kind of a larger share of biologics versus small molecules? And if that's the case in say 14, 15 years, that means more biosimilars. And so how can that market work to be able to generate and get prices to drop near the marginal cost of production while keeping all of the required incentives to have a healthy biosimilar market still in place?
Thanks for that answer. That really does help. And I think this is great because I've had a couple more questions for you, just that kind of go back to your world of pharmacoeconomics. And it's a world that I've heard about before. I didn't really start paying too much attention to that world until about 2 years ago. And I never met somebody in that world until, I had come across your name and we had started talking. And I think with everything that's going on now, forget people like me trying to help, solve those questions about what do we do with MFN and things like that. I think that, the world as it's going on right now fits what you're doing precisely because these are questions that really need to be asked. So I think these final three questions that I have for you are really more about your background and how you see the world. I think that's going to help our listeners understand other tools that they may use as the environment continues to change. So my first question for you is that you've actually looked at innovation from a perspective of value assessment in your past, and now from setting a much closer to companies and investors, my question is, has that changed how you think about what value actually means?
Yes, I have been so fortunate to work in a lot of amazing settings and kind of see different stakeholder perspectives and learn a ton. I think what has, how all of that has kind of molded together and shaped my perspective is now I think about things differently as it relates to time. We've said that time word a lot this episode, and I'm glad because time is so central to this, right? Like time of a product, the life cycle of a product, time of making a decision versus later term benefits, later term costs, time, like time horizons of policymakers, decision makers, health insurers, payers, all of this time is so central. And I think we need to do a better job thinking about time. Also, the price that we pay during that exclusivity period is not just, what is an acceptable price for that drug, but I've already mentioned this, it's also like a prize, not a price with a C, a prize with a Z. It's an incentive. This is what incentivizes future R&D, that we are this cycle, right? We do want, this was the very first question of this episode, we do want more innovation. More innovation is progress. To get that, we have to incentivize that innovation. And so there's this cycle that we have to be thinking about. The prices that we're paying today, those are the incentives for what we might be getting in the future. And so we've got to think about time. Time is so core and central to, investor decision making, development stage biotech companies, because they know they have a ticking time clock of if they get a drug that becomes approved, they have a ticking time clock for when that patent is eventually going to expire and generics can enter. And so we've got to be thinking about time in other sectors as well.
Well, I think other sectors where time is essential is economic models, and that's for certain. And you look at economic models now, and they're designed to help us make really hard decisions about healthcare. But in your opinion, what aspects of innovation or patient benefits are still difficult to quantify in these models?
So I love economic models. Like, economic models are what I build for work, and I, they're like, what I enjoy doing in my leisure time as well. I think about modeling for decisions all of the time. And they do help us make difficult healthcare decisions, and it is a way to kind of parameterize and quantify potential outcomes. I think where there is a disconnect still is, okay, here's an economic model for drug A versus standard of care. And maybe this is the price that would meet some price of the drug that would meet some opportunity cost threshold, right? And so maybe this is what we might call a cost-effective price or an efficient price. I think the disconnect is that the optimal incentive for innovation? There's kind of this disconnect between, okay, what is the efficient allocation of resources and what are the optimal incentives for future innovation? And so, where this gets complicated in economic models is, say, we get a finding. How do we interpret that in different settings, right? Like, what if this drug was in a rare disease? Should that be interpreted differently than for a drug that is in a condition that is a huge population size? What if it is a drug in a condition with huge unmet need? To go back to my mother-in-law's example, a condition where there's hardly anything available, should that be rewarded or looked at differently? What if it's a very, very severe condition? And so, how we interpret these estimates that come out of economic models and how that might differ by these, different settings or different, treatment landscapes, we still have a lot of work to do in that space. And so there's this difference between here's an efficient price or a price that would come less than the opportunity costs to, well, what is the optimal reward to the innovator? So we are incentivizing valuable innovation, and we're considering all of these incentives for innovation, population size, et cetera, competition into those economic models. So we still have some work to do.
And as you were talking, I was thinking about a very unsettling question that I sometimes ask myself, and it's very relevant here, especially when you were talking about your family situation that you've been through. Because when you're talking about innovation, and she had a very rare issue that she was dealing with, who matters? Who matters? Like what patient population matters? Why should we be incentivized to treat that patient when it's someone's mom or someone's grandmother, or something like that? And or are you too old to receive an experimental treatment? We talk about these models, and I mean, is that part of your world and thinking, or how does that may not be relevant, but it.
The models are interesting in that they can capture remaining life expectancy, but then there's still things that we can look at of, okay, here's your absolute shortfall in life expectancy versus proportionate. I think some of those questions get into ethics, which I am not an ethicist, and challenging conversations, challenging decisions. But I think I go back to an economic model should never be the single thing that a decision is based off of. Everybody talks about the George Box quote, all models are wrong, some are useful. And so I think models can be great tools, and can be a helpful way, again, to like parameterize and quantify certain things, but we definitely still need to have other things that supplement that model and decision making.
I agree. This leads me to my last question before I ask for your contact information, just in case our listeners want to get a hold of you offline about anything that we've talked about or some other things that they may be working on. And it's involving policymakers, right? Because we wouldn't be having these discussions if it weren't for policymakers. And we know, whether you're looking at the state legislature or Congress, and they operate on a lot of different, calendar windows, right? There's summer breaks, there's this, session period to that end date from the start date. And they think about a lot of important decisions in these very short budget windows. And you're thinking about this, and you're also thinking the push-pull of how that affects the benefits of innovation and how that unfolds over time. In your opinion, how should we think about that tension when deciding what innovation is actually worth when you have just a short amount of time to make a really, really important budget decision?
This is so hard, and
Not an
again,
easy question, right? I'm
no,
sorry about that.
it goes back to like time. Time is so important to all of this, but we often don't have the time, right? Like we don't have time to think about changes over time. I even think, in addition to policymakers, relevance here as well, and say, health insurance. Again, we talked about health insurance is, how things are affordable to patients over time. Health insurance often operates over short time period budgets. Say, here's my year-long premium. These are the decisions that I'm making out of this set of budget, but then what do we do in the future, right? So this is hard, and it also kind of requires like attempting to glimpse into the future, which is also really hard. I go back to my world of economic modeling and pharmacoeconomics, and I guess what I go back to is still this requires evidence-based assumptions. The more we can base our knowledge and our assumptions are inevitable, we'll have to make them, but as much as we can base those on evidence, the better. If we can use historical patterns, historical data to inform that, all the better. And then particularly as we're thinking about innovation's worth, thinking about innovation over its product lifetime, over its life cycle, not during, its first year at launch, not during, its market exclusivity period where the price is intended to be high, but thinking long term. So this issue of how do we prioritize and consider long term progress and promise when we're faced with such short term, we need a decision now challenges. That's an issue, but it's the world we live in.
No doubt, I understand. Well, I know we've been talking for a while, and I know that I mentioned earlier here that this is our season finale. So I am definitely going to offer you a place to come back, hopefully in season two,
That'd be
and
great.
we can continue these conversations because we've hit on a lot of heavy topics. And it is for I'm going to actually think about a lot of what you said tonight, and maybe these are going to be a couple of blog posts that I put out because. These things are important, and I think this field that you're in is fascinating, especially with the time that we're living in. So, if you wouldn't mind, if you can give our listeners a way to contact you, and just in case they have questions.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, find me on LinkedIn, Melanie Whittington, or my email is Melanie, my first name, period Whittington, my last name, at medicorp.com, MEDACORP.com. I would love to hear from your listeners. I would love to continue the conversation. I'd love to come back because I do think the more that we talk about not only the prices of drugs, not only their profits or potential profits, but the more we talk about the potential impact on patients, on the healthcare system, on society, and like this larger progress that innovation can provide, we've got to talk about that, and not enough people are talking about that.
I agree. Well, thank you so much. Again, that was Melanie Whittington. She is the managing director and head of the center, Leerink Center for Pharmacoeconomics. Sorry, that's a long name.
It is.
We will get that right. And I'm Ron Lanton. This has been a great season, and we look forward to talking to you guys again next season.